Vaydaber Adonai El Moshe Lemor Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen Heshiv Eschamasi Me'al B'nei Yisrael Bekano Eskinasi B'socham V'lo Chilisi Es B'nei Yisrael Bekinasi Lachain emor hineni notain lo esberisi shalom. Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, Pinchas the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the Kohen, turned back my wrath from upon the children of Israel when he zealously avenged my vengeance among them. So I did not consume the children of Israel in my vengeance. Therefore, say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace. Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernovsky, and this show is for Parshat Pinchas. Recording and first broadcast. I'll tell you. It's Yom Chamishi, no surprise there. Thursday, the 22nd day of Tammuz, 5775, corresponding to July 9th. Not only is this Parshat Pinchas, but we also bench Rosh Chodesh, announcing Rosh Chodesh Av, which will be next Friday, July 17th, the first day of Av. A few comments about that before we proceed. And that is, there seems to have been some communities, maybe in Europe, who felt that we shouldn't announce the coming of Rosh Chodesh Av. Rosh Chodesh Av is a month associated with tragedy and calamity, to the point where the Mishnah says, Mishenichnas Av Mima'atim B'Simcha. As Av enters, we diminish in joy. And that notion, that idea of not having Rosh Chodesh benching for Av was shot down by the rabbinate, because if any month needs to be blessed and announced, it's Chodesh Av. We actually refer to it at Rosh Chodesh benching as Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av, the comforting month of Av, and there are various customs, one of which I think is the most popular, which I follow, and that is to identify the month as Av for the first 10 days, and thereafter, which means two-thirds of the month, we call it Menachem Av. And that gives you a balance. The first 9 days are the 9 days. We'll talk about that in next week's show, Amir Tzashem. For now, we are at the beginning of, or towards the beginning of, the 3 weeks. This past Sunday was Shivasar B'Tammuz, postponed from Shabbat, and we're already Thursday, so we're into the beginning portion of the 3 weeks. Hence, the music that opened the show was vocal only. Actually comes from an album which I bought this morning, and the album is called Fabreng. It has 22 tracks on it, comes in two CDs, one that has musical accompaniment to the songs, and the other which is voice only, and therefore can be played and listened to during Sfirat HaOmer and Bein HaMitzarim, which is the other name for the 3 weeks. We'll talk more about that in a little while. In the meantime, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shimavakoli Tihiena Oznecha Kashuvot Lakol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmor Yah Adonai Miya Amod. Ki Imacha Hasalicha Lama'an Tivare. Kiviti Adonai Kivata Nafshi Velidvaro Hochalti. Nafshi Ladonai Mi Shomerim Laboker Shomerim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed Vaharbe Imo Fedut. Zehu Yifde et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav. Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanatunim Batzara Vashivya Haomedim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha Hamakom Yerachem Aleihem Vyotziyem Mitzara Lirvacha Umeafela Laora Umishibud Lageula Hashta Ba'agala Uvizman Kariv Vinomar Amen. There are usually two things or two aspects that I like to cover in the show. One is the calendar and one is the Parsha of the week. And I find very poignantly the not compatibility but almost the contrast between the Parsha or part of it and the calendar. I'll start with that and then we'll try to do an overview of the Sedra and throw in a lot of little things. I shouldn't call them little, a lot of things. The thing that I can't forget about is the fact that Parshat Pinchas is either immediately before the 3 weeks begin, before Shivasar B'Tammuz, or after Shivasar B'Tammuz, and that makes it very much a 3 weeks kind of Sedra, specifically Shivasar B'Tammuz. And I say specifically because one of the themes of Parshat Pinchas are the korbanot in the Beit HaMikdash, the sacrifices in the temple, beginning with the daily sacrifices, twice a day, once in the morning, once late afternoon, before evening. The musafim, the additional sacrifices on Shabbat, on Rosh Chodesh, on Pesach, on Shavuot, on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. And getting back to the beginning of that portion, the daily sacrifice. The daily sacrifice has a very special role, I'm not so sure if that's the best word, in Jewish life, both in the time of the Beit HaMikdash and even when Beit HaMikdash doesn't stand. The concept is perpetuated by our davening schedule, where we have the morning service, which corresponds to the Tamid of the morning, and Mincha, which corresponds to the Tamid of the afternoon, and Arvit, the third davening, corresponds to the burning on the altar, simmering on the altar of various parts of the day's korbanot. But the Korban Tamid is a symbol of Jewish unity and continuity. Jewish unity because the animals for the sacrifices, the communal sacrifices, were purchased from the collection of Machatzit HaShekel, which was basically a annual tax on the population, where rich people couldn't give more, poor people couldn't give less than the half silver shekel, the message being that we're all in this together and we all have an equal share. So there is the unity, the continuity is simply every morning and every evening, every morning and every evening, one after the other after the other. On the other hand, according to our tradition, during the siege around Jerusalem, in the time of the first Beit HaMikdash, one of the remarkable occurrences was that the Jewish people in Yerushalayim managed to continue, I don't know really exactly how long, the bringing of the Tamidim, having been able to smuggle in the lambs to be used in the Beit HaMikdash. But on Shivas Arba Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, which also marks the breaking of the tablets and the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf, and the breach of Jerusalem, it also marks the cessation of that continuity of the Korban Tamid. So that's a tragedy which we commemorate right around the Shabbat that we read the portion of Parshat Pinchas. There's more, and I tried to get it across in the lead tidbit this week in Torah Tidbits, and that's basically the idea that since the middle of Parshat Beha'alotcha, things have not been good. You have complaining and plagues that punish people, and the sin of the spies, and the aftermath of that, which was devastating to the population, deemed male adults to wander around for the 40-year period and die out, and not go into Eretz Yisrael. You had Korach's rebellion, and the aftermath of that, where the people were very much in despair, and felt that the people of Israel would soon perish. And you have Moshe Rabbeinu hitting the rock instead of speaking to the rock, and his being punished for it. And things, Aharon dies, Miriam dies. It's not a happy time from the middle of Balotcha through Shlach, Korach, Chukat, and Bullock, with the thwarted attempt to curse the Jewish people, thwarted by God, and then the devastating 24,000 victims of the plague that resulted after the worship of Baal Peor. Not good stuff. You come to Pinchas and things are looking up. You have the census that is taken of the generation who are soon to go across the Jordan into Eretz Yisrael. There is also the beautiful display of love of Eretz Yisrael in stark contrast to that generation of the Meraglim, in the form of the daughters of Tzelafchad, who presented a claim, and the laws of inheritance were set down, and Moshe Rabbeinu transferred the leadership of the people at God's command to Yehoshua, and things are looking up. And then the Korbanot, which referred to mostly life in Eretz Yisrael with the Beit HaMikdash, and as I said, things are looking up. Then you look up from the Torah portion and you notice the calendar again, and here we go again, because the sin of the golden calf, which by Parshat Pinchas is way behind us, here it is again with Shivas Arba Tammuz, and Tisha B'Av with the sin of the spies, and all kind of other sins. And calendar is cyclic. And then we realize that Torah reading is also cyclic. In other words, it would be one thing to say that by the time we reach Parshat Pinchas, things are looking up, except for the fact that we're not dealing with a straight line, we're dealing with a circle, because that's how we read the Torah portions. Soon as we finish V'zot HaBracha on Simchat Torah, we're going to start with Bereishit. So that the sin of the golden calf is not just behind us, it's ahead of us as well. The sin of the spies is not just behind us, it's ahead of us as well. And so maybe it's not so much of a contrast as it is a reminder of the cyclic nature of Jewish history, manifest or symbolized by the cyclic reading of the Torah, and of course the calendar, which by definition involves cycles. With that said, let's now take a look at Parshat Pinchas. Parshat Pinchas begins where last Sedra of Balak left off. I mentioned last week that we had a cliffhanger there. We had the dramatic events of the Midianites and the Moabites teaming up together to have their women seduce Jewish men from the people of Israel to the orgiastic worship of Baal Peor. And that was not just the riffraff, that was included tribal leaders, and not all of them, of course, but some, and a devastating plague broke out. Most everybody was sort of frozen into inaction, and Pinchas, without asking permission, grabbed a spear and killed Zimri, one of the leaders of Shevet Shimon, and the Midianite princess Cusbi, with whom he was cavorting, and the plague stopped. That's how last week's Sedra ends. You look in the commentaries and you look in Midrashim, and you'll see that the people of Shevet Shimon especially wanted Pinchas brought up on charges of murder for killing their leader, and were not at all happy with what happened. And it took no less than God to calm the situation down by announcing that he thanks Pinchas for defending his honor. And as a result, he gave Pinchas not a medal of war, but the Brit Kuhunat Olam, the covenant of peace. And that also awakens in us a strange thing. Here, a clear act of violence, taking the law into his own hands and killing two people, was exactly what was needed and called for, not in a let's discuss it form, but in an instinctive action of kanaut, zealotry, and confirmed by God as right on the mark. Does not mean that we can learn to do those kind of things. It's like a don't try this at home kind of situation. But Pinchas was given Brit Kuhunat Olam and God's covenant of peace. As far as the kahuna, somebody asked me yesterday, and it reminded me that not everybody knows the situation, so it does bear repeating. It goes like this. When Aharon became a Kohen, he was anointed with a special oil in a ceremony that basically changed his status from Levi, non-Kohen, there was no such thing yet, to Kohen. Also included in that ceremony were his four sons, Nadav and Avihu, Elazar and Itamar. Nadav and Avihu died subsequently without having children, and the Kohanic line, so to speak, continues with Elazar and Itamar. And the rule of the kahuna is that these five people were anointed Kohen. That's why they are Kohanim. All children in perpetuity, generation after generation, born from them, are Kohanim. And the one person that fell between the cracks was Pinchas. Because Pinchas, the son of Elazar, was already alive at the time that his father, uncles, and grandfather were anointed Kohanim. He was not anointed a Kohen, nor was he born to a Kohen. And therefore, he was not a Kohen. At this point in Parshat Pinchas, he is given by God the divine gift of Kohunat Olam, and therefore, we can say now that a person is a Kohen either because he was anointed as a Kohen. The examples are Aharon, Nadav, Avihu, Elazar, and Itamar. Or He was born of a Kohen, which is just about all the Kohanim that have ever existed and will continue to exist, and Pinchas, because he received the divine gift. So that's the story of Pinchas. Then God commands Moshe to gather an army and take revenge against Midian. Notice, not Moab. Moab was an honest enemy. They were scared of us. They attempted to fight against us. They lost. End of story. But Midian joined into the action because they wanted to destroy the fledgling nation of Israel. And that is what God commanded us to avenge, his honor and our honor, by fighting against Midian and conquering. That was put on hold for the remainder of the Sedra. And you have the census that, as I mentioned earlier, will be the people who will go into Eretz Yisrael. We're talking about men from age 20 and up, military age. Women were not punished by dying out in the Midbar. And one, I guess, assumes that the female population followed the laws of nature over the course of the 40 years, and many, many more women than men were able to go into Eretz Yisrael. Now, with this men, the five daughters of Tzelophehad, who had no brothers, came to Moshe and presented their claim and complaint. They said, our grandfather, I'm adding now, filling out the details, our grandfather Hefer was one of the people who was counted in the census when they left Egypt. So he is due a portion in the land of Israel. Our father Tzelophehad was Hefer's firstborn. And he also was over the age of 20 when he left Egypt and counted in that census. Therefore, we should be able to inherit the portion that would have gone to Tzelophehad if he were alive, and would have gone to Hefer if he were alive. In other words, what's the story? That we have no brother and our father is not alive anymore. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more Torah Tibbetz audio for Parshat Pinchas. Okay, we're just going to plunge right in. No music. We're listening. You're listening to Torah Tibbetz audio. I'm recording it. And we were talking about the foundation, we'll say, or the springboard for the Torah's presenting the laws of inheritance. Now, before I get into that, there are two areas of mitzvah of the Torah which seem to come from a story, not as part of revelation at Sinai, but as some kind of afterthought. I reject that notion, but it seems to work out that way if you just take the written word on face value. I'm referring to the first annual celebration of Pesach, which was done by the bringing of the Korban Pesach, followed by individuals who were tamei and were not able to participate in the Korban Pesach, who said, it's not fair, we want to be part of this mitzvah also. And God sets down, at that point in the Torah, the laws of Pesach Sheni. These are back in Bahalotcha. I don't want to go into them again now, but basically, it was not, this is what I'm saying, it was not, God says, well, you know what, I didn't think of this before, but as long as you're asking, do it 1 month after, Pesach on the 14th of Iyar, and you'll be happy. It's not like that. Part of revelation at Sinai to Moshe to be given to the people of Israel were all the mitzvot of the Torah, including the mitzvot of Pesach Sheni. They weren't issued to the people, taught to the people, learned with the people, until the event occurred at that first annual Pesach, that individuals came and they said, it's not fair that we should be left out. And there are different reasons given for why. The other example is the daughters of Tzelophchad. The laws of inheritance are set down as a result of what the daughters of Tzelophchad claimed and complained about. And one should not think that this was an afterthought on God's part to assuage the feminist gang that came to protest. Not like that. Not acceptable. Part of revelation at Sinai were the laws of inheritance, which I'm about to review with you, and they were presented to the people in the episode of Benot Slavchad coming with their claim. I think it's an important thing to keep in mind. Anyway, it goes like this. If a man dies, his sons inherit. Even if there are daughters, the sons only inherit. Important thing to add, based on the law in the Mishnah, sons who inherit from their father are obligated to take care, financial care, of their sisters even before they take care of themselves. In other words, if there's enough to go around for everybody, then everybody benefits. But if there's not enough to go around, the girls get, even if the boys, the sons who inherited, have nothing left and they have to go begging door to door. That's an important thing to keep in mind when a first reaction is, what do you mean daughters don't inherit? And by the way, a wife does not either. It is the sons that inherit. If there are no sons, the daughters inherit. If there are no children at all, then a man is inherited by his father. If his father is not around, then you go, in other words, from the man, you try to go down the family tree to his children. If there are no children, you go up to the father. If he's not around, you go back down. The son that we're talking about is deceased, but he might have brothers. Those brothers inherit where the man had no children. And if there are no brothers, then the sisters inherit. In other words, five girls, five boys in a family, a man dies without children. Bad example. Five girls, one guy. The guy dies without children. The grandfather is no longer alive. The five daughters, the five sisters of the deceased, share his estate. If there are no uncles or aunts, you go further up the family tree to the great-grandfather, and if he's not around, which he probably isn't, you go down his branches, and that will come to uncles, and if no uncles, then aunts, etc. And after detailing that, the Torah just says, and if there are none of those, then to the closest family relation that you could find in that similar kind of going up and back down the branches of a family tree. Now that's the laws of inheritance as set down by the Torah, as clarified and expanded upon in the Mishnah. And now, I'm warning you in advance, I'm not going to do total justice to this issue, but I hope to give you enough to be able to pursue it in a more professional way if you need. Reality today. A man, elderly, wants to write a will to take care of his family. So the man, let's say, let's leave the wife out of the picture for the moment, although if she's in the picture, it works out similar to what I'm going to describe now. A man has a son and a daughter, and he writes a will that says, I, so-and-so, of sound mind and body, do hereby bequeath my estate to be shared equally by my son and daughter. Basically, according to Jewish law, as set down by Torah, Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, says that that will is not valid because the man was going against what the Torah says, and that is that his son inherits and his daughter does not. And therefore, he can't say any different. Not the whole story yet. Let's say a man writes away all of his property before he dies to his best friend Joe, freezing out his sons, in essence disinheriting his sons. In this case, the Mishnah tells us, Masha asa asui, what is done, because even though you cannot control your possessions after you're gone, during your lifetime you could pretty much do whatever you want. So if he gives a deathbed gift to his best friend Joe, in essence freezing out of the picture his sons, whom the Torah expected to inherit. Masha asa asui, what is done, but he has not behaved properly. The language in the Mishnah, aval ein ruach chachamim nocha hemeno, the spirit of the sages do not smile upon such a person. In other words, the Torah did not want you to disinherit your son. You wanted to. You're going against the wishes of the Torah, and you found the legal procedure that would have to be accepted by Jewish law, namely a gift during your lifetime. But since your intention was to disinherit your son, we say to you, no, you shouldn't have done that. It's the wrong thing to do. Now, we take these two extremes and we try to find a method by which a man's wishes that his son and his daughter, and you could use your own examples of this, but I'm using it to simplify matters, a man wants his estate shared by his son and daughter. He does not want to rely on the son to give an allowance to the daughter so she can live in the manner to which she has become accustomed, as the expression goes. He wants her to get half. He needs to execute a kosher document which does not use the language of bequeathing inheritance, because there you're talking about, if you go against what the Torah says, it's invalid. So the will is constructed in such a way that he gives gifts to his son and his daughter, and the key here is he's not freezing out his son, he's not disinheriting his son, he just wants to apportion his estate between his two children, or among his 10 children, whatever the case may be. And that, pretty much to simplify, is not going to incur the displeasure of the spirit of the sages, because his goal was a positive one, not a negative one. Now, again, I warned you that this is an oversimplified view, not an overview, an oversimplified presentation, but I will add that the Mishnah does speak about changing the proportion of the amount that different sons will receive, and that's doable according to the halacha, one opinion in the Mishnah and the opinion which we follow. So the Mishnah and the rules that it sets down for inheritance open the door to allow for situations, if they are done properly, for equalizing the share of the firstborn with his brothers, even though the Torah requires his getting a double portion. And there are one or two other methods by which not only can a person accomplish what he would like with his estate, and that includes wife and daughters, etc., and charities and friends, but not to disinherit a child. That's considered a serious breach of what the Torah wants, and sometimes it is invalid, and sometimes mashasa asui, but you shouldn't have done it. But that's a different kind of thing, and all of this needs a lot more elaboration than I'm able to give now. And you should just know that such a thing exists. A further complication is that in any country that a person lives, there are laws of inheritance which the country is going to insist on that they be followed. And when they clash with Jewish law, you have a situation which is, let's just call it unpleasant. Whenever something like that happens, and some of the children want to go to court, and others want to go to a din Torah, and one might be religious, another might not be religious, or who cares about that, and whatever, that's why one would need a properly executed document that would be acceptable in the country in which he lives as a way of, a kosher way of redistributing or distributing his estate. If you're still listening, I've spent a lot of time on this topic, and I'll spend just a little bit more, but with a strong recommendation to do your own research and reading and asking, and consultations with lawyers that are well-versed and care about this kind of situation. Dying intestate, meaning without leaving a request or a document of any sort, is not a great solution, because there again you'll have a clash between Jewish law and secular law, and we don't say in this case secular law prevails, nor do we say that you can insist on Jewish law and expect to get away with it, when depending on the laws of the country. So that will create problems. Of course, the problems are solved when heirs to an individual are of the same mind and understand the meaning of what the Torah wants and what their father or mother wanted, and cooperate with each other. But you can't assume that. I remember my mother telling me about a friend of hers who hadn't spoken to her sister in 30 years over a dispute of the inheritance from the parents' estate. And I cried. The concept, the idea of not speaking to your own sibling for 30 years, that's not what siblings are supposed to be. They're supposed to be loving. So it's a problem, and it's a problem that we, Baruch Hashem, have good solutions for, and anyone who needs to do something should consult the professionals in the field. Let me switch over to matters of the 3 weeks. I really should review what I told you last week, but very briefly, since the Mishnah presents the calamities that occurred on the 17th of Tammuz and the ones associated with the 9th of Av, it turns out that the Ashkenazi world sort of took those as the bookends of a period of time which is all mournful, and it's called, as I said before, the 3 weeks, or Bein HaMetzarim. Sfaradim, in general, didn't go in that direction, because the Mishnah does not go in that direction. The only thing the Mishnah says is Shivasar B'Tammuz, 17th of Tammuz, is a day of commemorating tragedies and fasting, and so is Tisha B'Av, and Mishenichnas Av Mima'atim B'Simcha, when Av enters, we diminish in joy, and there are various and sundry rules and regulations that apply to the 9-day period coming up, and to the week in which Tisha B'Av falls. This year, by the way, with Tisha B'Av on Shabbat, there's a question as to whether the week before that Shabbat is Shavua Shechalbo, the week in which Tisha B'Av falls, or do we say that since the fast is postponed till Sunday, that there is no week in which Tisha B'Av falls? But the details of all of that are much too much for us to handle here. I would say, even if it's repeating something I mentioned last week, that an important motivator is the Gemara that makes the statement, Kol HaMitabel Al Yerushalayim Zoche V'Roe B'Simchata. Those who mourn Jerusalem will be privileged to see its rejoicing. And the Gemara in Tanit adds, and he who does not mourn Jerusalem will not be privileged to see the rejoicing. And I think it's a worthwhile thing to pursue. I personally try to behave in such a way, let me put it a little differently. The most important thing during the 3 weeks or the 9 days or the week in which Tisha B'Av falls or Tisha B'Av day itself is thinking. To plug yourself in, not to do things by rote, but to give an honest evaluation to your course of conduct if it reflects mourning Churban Beit HaMikdash, the destruction of the temples, or not. Now, this could mean, I think, two very different things. You have some people who say, finished. The exile is over. There's the State of Israel. The population, Jewish population of the State of Israel has grown tenfold since 1948 and continues to grow. And what more is there, you know, to mourn the desolation of Jerusalem? Look around Jerusalem. Do you see desolation? Or do you see new building projects and renovations and more this and more that? And it's a wonderful thing. So the type of Jew that says, who needs Shivasar B'Tammuz, who needs Tisha B'Av anymore, is missing a very crucial point. One mourns Jerusalem until it is completed, meaning with the Beit HaMikdash, with the Sanhedrin, with the Jews flocking back to Eretz Yisrael, and not as it stands now, where the majority of the Jews of the world, close to 50%, a little more, but still the majority of Jews in the world, don't live in Israel. And even when we tip that balance to over 50% for here, there'll still be a very sizable minority of the Jewish population of the world who don't live in Israel. So all of these things are signs that the galut, The exile still continues, even though many Jews believe that they are experiencing the Atchalta de Geula, the beginning of the redemption, or, in other words, Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, which is the description of Eretz Yisrael, of the state of Israel, that it is the beginning of the flowering of redemption. So you don't want to say beginning of the flowering of redemption, you want to say the flowering of redemption, it's partial redemption, it's whatever, but not to be fooled into thinking that that's it, we're done, we're not done yet. So there, we're in the tunnel, it's still dark, but we see the light at the end of the tunnel very clearly, and we also notice that the light is filtering in our direction as we approach it, and it's getting more and more to the gray, and the brightness is right there within our grasp. And that's pretty much all we have time for this issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehish Tameach.